Welcome to Escape from Cubicle 17, Episode 11, for Tuesday, October 27th, 2009. And here is my interview with Howard Waldrop, recorded last month at FenCon 6. Welcome to Escape from Cubicle 17. This is Chris Murley, your host, and today I have the a rather well-known author that is not as well-known as he should be, and that's Howard Waldrop. We're recording live at FenCon 6, and he was supposed to be a guest here last year, and unfortunately he wasn't able to attend, and I wasn't able to interview him then, but I am now, so I really appreciate him taking the time to sit down with me. And so, Howard, you were at ArmadilloCon a couple weeks ago, about a month ago, and they awarded you a prize called the Jack Trevor Story Memorial Cup.
Yes.
And I do want to ask a couple questions about the award, but the first question I want to ask was I read that there was a $1,000 prize that went with it.
This was the astounding part of it is Mike Moorcock presented it, and he kept referring to it as an insubstantial sum, right? You know, so I figured, and it was in an envelope, and I figured it was going to be, you know, $25 in small unmarked bills or something, right? Because one of the conditions they give you is that you have to spend it within a fortnight, right, because it's originally a British prize. You have to spend it within a fortnight, and you can't have anything to show for it after you spend it, right, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was expecting like $25, which I know ways to get rid of that, you know, right, real quick, right, you know, and stuff. And I opened it up, and it was a check, right, you know? And I didn't know at the time that I was the first American to get it.
Wow.
And if I'm not mistaken, John Sladek got one before he died, right? If I'm back in the late 80s, something like that, whenever it was, early 90s and stuff. But I'm in some august company, right, you know, and stuff. And I believe it was named for his stuff is almost, it's so something that it's almost surreal, right?
Yeah, what I was reading was basically for a body of work that embodied his work. And so I had to go look him up because I'm not as well read as I would like to be. But I did recognize one title, and that was a book called The Trouble with Harry, which was turned into an Alfred Hitchcock movie,
right,
with a very young Shirley MacLaine,
right, John Forsythe. Right?
Yeah, John Forsythe, right. And that was a great movie. So I had an idea of who he was now,
mm-hmm.
And there was another novel which I hadn't heard of, and apparently one of the authors, a lot of authors in England liked him. One of them was Michael Moorcock, so I guess
right.
That's how he got to be
right.
The executor.
And like the people who the jury this year, it's an informal jury type thing, but like I respect all their tastes. You know what I mean, right? You know, it wasn't just, you know, people that I, you know, never heard of or anything like that. They're people that I know. You know, some of them I know and some of them I don't, but I respect all their work, you know, and stuff like that. So I felt, you know, it floored me because I didn't know it was coming, for one thing, right? And you know, Mike just said, I gotta do a presentation here, stand right here for a minute, right, you know, while I do this, right, you know. And so he starts into the spiel, right, you know, and then he announces it was me, right, and I didn't have a clue, right, you know, that it was coming. Right?
Well, I think it's best sometimes, you know, an award should be best served cold.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
And especially by people that that feel that your work is worthy. And of course, I'm one of those fans that do think your work is worthy of such a prize. I guess the next question is do you mind telling us what some of the things you bought with that $1,000 are?
I didn't so much buy it as spend it, right?
Wow.
You know what I mean? Right,
yeah.
And stuff. And I have nothing to show for at least half of it right now, right? You know, and I'm trying to get the rest of it out of the way real
mm-hmm.
quick, right? You know, and stuff. But it's like I have nothing tangible to show for it, right?
Well, I think that's what one of the stipulations of the prize was.
Nothing,
so.
Yeah, nothing to show for it at the end of it, right? You know. Well, of course, like I said, it's my kind of award, which it's an award that has money with it, right?
Yes.
You know, and stuff. That's really great because most of them don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the is it the Clark? Not is Clark Award has some money with it, doesn't it?
So.
I think so. And one of the Libertarian Awards of some kind has
mm-hmm.
some money with it, right?
But well, probably ought to come with a prize.
Exactly, right? But like, you know, the Hugo and the Nebula don't come with any money, right?
It comes with the prestige,
right? As Steve Utley says, all all the glory you can eat, right?
all the glory.
Right? You know, and stuff. But it's like, anyway, it was a complete surprise to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a clue. I came back from supper that night and was going to the mm-hmm. going to a program item, you know, right?
Of course, you want to, and it was a nebula for the Ugly Chickens, correct? Or was it the
yes.
Cute?
Yeah. Yes.
And then you also got a World Fantasy Award.
World Fantasy Award. For
and, of course, you've been nominated numerous times for other stories, Hugos and Nebulas and stuff like that.
As I referred to them, tickets to Palookaville, right? You know, I've got a drawer full of, like, you know, the convention committees uh-huh. or the nebula jury and stuff. Uh-huh. They print up they have a neat-looking, you know, like letterhead type thing, you know, with your name and stuff on it, you know. Now, let everybody know that you were up for the award, but, you know, that's what I got to show for it, yeah. Right? You know?
Now, I have to confess, I haven't read that many of your short stories, but I've read enough of them to see that you've got a very unique, that's redundant, but
right.
a unique voice that really stands out. And I would favorably compare you, not necessarily the style of your writing, but that it stands out in science fiction and fantasy to Cordwainer Smith and to R.A. Lafferty.
That's it's like any time anybody is you know, as I say, and you know, when in the World Fantasy Con in '95, when mm-hmm. me and Terry Bisson and Lucia Shepard were the three guests of honor, right? It said honoring the short fiction field, right? You know. And I said they should put a subtitle saying, and three guys who can't make a living at it, right? You know, to be honest about it, right? You know, and stuff like that. But it's like anytime anybody's comparing me to people, then those names come mm-hmm. up. And the other one is Avram Davidson is the
okay.
other name that comes up. And the only thing I can think of is those are guys who really couldn't really make a living at it either, right? You know, and stuff.
Well,
and they were... You know, they were mostly known for their short work,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You know, it's the thing about
well,
it, right?
Lafferty didn't actually start writing until he was 55.
Right, exactly. He said he sobered up and started listening to the other drunks.
Yeah.
Is what got him writing, right? You know, but like he was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. He was phenomenal.
Well, I had the good fortune of meeting Lafferty on a number of occasions,
mm-hmm.
so. So I actually had some nice conversations with him. Of course, this was long before I started even thinking about doing podcasting.
Right.
So I know some people's like, well, who can I compare him to? So I want to say I'm sincere in that comparison.
Right. No. So. It's like I said, I think it's because most of them, you know, did mm-hmm. short work, right? You know, that mm-hmm. You know, the people, you know, read and stuff like that. You know, nobody talks about Lafferty's novels much,
yeah.
except maybe for Oklahoma Lee or
The Devil Is.
Yeah, Devil Is Due in the Past Master.
And I think Fall of Rome as well.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. Although, you know, that I've seen that classified in it's in the history section of mm-hmm. libraries and stuff, right? You know?
Well, I'd first heard of that. Someone else was looking for a copy of it, and I was like, and they said it was like really, really hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually known under another title called Alaric. I managed to acquire a copy of it. But anyway, back to you.
Right. I'll talk about Lafferty all day.
Yeah.
If you want to, right? You know?
Of course, you have a number of short story collections. I did write them down here. Of course, your first one was Howard Who. Mm-hmm. And that may be what a lot of people have. They have a question about is, who are you?
Right.
But and you're much admired by your fellow writers. I see all these notes. You know, George R. R. Martin, who you mm-hmm. apparently have a very long-standing friendship with, and of course Brad Denton, who I interviewed right. last year, are some of the others. Now, your two most recent ones are actually selections of ones of your short fiction, which is Things Will Never Be the Same,
right.
1980 to 2005, and then Other Worlds, Better Lives, if I can read my handwriting,
right.
Selected long fiction, 89 to 2003. Now, were those self-selected, or did you have any help in selecting those?
We argued endlessly in a friendly fashion, right? As somebody said, you can't do that story, you can't put that story in if you don't put this in too, right? You know, and all this stuff. And anyway, it came down to a list we me and Mike Walsh both agreed on, right? The publisher, and stuff, and like, and you know, everything was on there at first. I said, this thing is going to be like 9,000 pages long if you put everything you want to put in there, right? You know, and the idea originally was like Howard Waters' greatest hits, or the Howard Waters Reader, which is the subtitle on both of them, I think, right? You know, and stuff, and I kept. He wanted, you know, the first one to be all short stories and stuff, and except he said, I want in there, the one that had just been up for the Hugo and stuff, and he said I want the Hugo nominees in there. I said, you've already got four Hugo nominees in there, right? He said, no, I mean the most recent one. I said, well, then that's a novella, you know, right? You didn't tell me you wanted novelette in the first one. And he said, you know, we are, you know, it was mostly semantics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and stuff, right? But that was the only longer work in the first one, and the longer ones are all in the second book, right? You know, and stuff, and like, you know, that was the hardest one to get down to a manageable size, right? You know, because I've written, as somebody said, you know, right, in this field, if you want, you know, there are never enough good novellas every year, right? You know, the novella is probably the easiest category to be nominated for in either Nebula or Hugo, because, you know, there aren't that many good ones, except, of course, you have one year like 1977 where you had four great novellas by four different people that came out all in the same year, right? You know, mm-hmm. any year, if those novellas would have come out in any other year, they would have won. Each one of them would have won.
Yeah.
But they all came out the same year, and had to fight each other, right?
Well, that happens.
Right. It was like, that was the year that Tiptree won for Houston mm-hmm. Reed, right, you know?
Yeah.
But there was a Bishop and a Gene Wolfe and a Richard Cowper, right, you know, that later became Road to Corlay, right? It was the novella version of Road to Corlay, I think, right?
Okay. Yeah, I think so. I'm going to jump around a little bit because I didn't organize my notes as well as I would have liked.
All right.
Because we're at FinCon, we just got out of a panel, which was an hour with Howard Waldrop, mm-hmm. which was, of course, your interviewer, Brad Denton, was late because he had to go change his shirt.
Right, exactly. And, he just played a musical gig. Right.
Yeah, now. As Bland Lemon Denton.
Right.
You described him as being, what, sparkly?
Sparkle, like,
sparkle.
Women sparkle, uh-huh. Horses sweat, and
yeah.
Men perspire, right? You know, is the old phrase, right? You know,
yeah.
And stuff. But anyway, he got in a little late, mm-hmm. but then the interview went fine, you know, right?
Or, yeah.
Whatever he would just prompt me, right? You know, turn me loose, right? You know?
Yeah. Now, one of the mentions when you were talking briefly about Ugly Chickens, mm-hmm. Someone said like alternate history, but it's not really alternate history. I think the other term they use is called secret history. It doesn't change anything what we know mm-hmm. about history, but it adds a twist like, oh, so that's how it really happened. You know, it still
right.
doesn't change the final outcome,
right?
But it's something that you didn't know before.
Right, right. Exactly. It's like the outcome is still the same, like the last line of the story is the dodo's still dead, right?
Yeah.
You know, which is true, right? You know, but it's like, it wasn't like an alternate history story, mm-hmm. you know, like when I wrote it, I didn't approach it that way. I was just trying to tell, you know, the story of what would have happened if somebody had brought some dodos to America while they were still alive,
yeah.
right? You know, in the pre-colonial days.
Yeah.
You know, right?
And I think to a writer, I think that adds a little more challenge because you want to have the same outcome, but you got to figure out how it's going to work out where the end result's going to be the same,
right.
But you want to tell an interesting story.
Right. That story took more than 6 months to write. It was a really hard story because I was doing all the research and I had to give all this information. Right, you know, and stuff, and I suddenly realized, I said, why don't I just do info dumps, right, instead
yeah.
of trying to put this all in a story, you know, as you know, Bob, right,
yeah.
you know, the old cliche, you know, one guy's telling another one stuff that he would know being working in that field too, right, and stuff like that, but like, instead of that, I just stopped the story and told the reader what they needed to know, like the history of the whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
right, you know. and then started the story back up again, right? Which I'd never done a story like that before, right? Because, you know, supposedly that's taught against in most, you know, most people trying to teach you writing, you know, right? You know, you don't stop a story and then tell people what they, something they need to know and then go back to the story.
Well, I think as long as the story is interesting and it keeps your attention, it keeps turning that page, you know, if you're a good enough writer, then you can get away with it. You know, some people, you know, it's like you want to...
Right,
it's like, okay, when does it get interesting again? You know, or put it down, right. Which is could be a lot worse. Now, you had an interesting discussion about A Dozen Chef Jobs being the 12 Labors of Hercules.
Right.
And I'd actually read earlier about the Coen brothers did Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is Odyssey, also set same time period, Mississippi, pre-Depression, and how you had to solve a lot of the same problems or came to the same conclusion on doing things in them. And it's interesting is that, you know, they came out fairly close to each other.
Right.
I had interviewed Eric Flint, and his novel 1632 came out about the same time as S.M. Sterling's Islands in the Stream. Mm-hmm. Both of them were basically stories about cities that got, you know, fell back in time. And they obviously had written them independently, but that's just one of the things that happened because I guess there's so many writers out there, and sometimes ideas just floating around that might trigger the same inspiration in somebody.
People used to refer to that as steam engine time.
Steam engine
time.
It's
time for the steam engine to be invented. It'll be invented no matter who did it, right? You know, and stuff. But like, you know, that's like I mean, like I said when I was talking about the Coen Brothers movie, they had to solve some of the same problems filmmaking about the culture as I did writing my book, right? You know, you had to do certain things, right? You know, and I wanted, one of the things is I wanted to set it in you know, pre-Depression Mississippi, because I wanted Lindbergh's flight in there. And the comparison was to the flight of Icarus, of course, right?
Oh, okay.
You know, right, and stuff. And because the kid comes back, you know, from the country, and the place is going crazy, right? You know, and he says to somebody, "What happened?" You know, right? And this lady says, "Lindbergh made it." Says, "They had you down a well for the last 3 days, right?" You know, something like that, because that was all the news in America at the time, right? You know, and stuff. But I wanted that. I knew it had to be set around 27, because, of course, 27 was also the big Mississippi River flood.
Oh yeah,
right? You know, and stuff. And I wanted that in there for other parts of the book, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because I know that there was I think the term was a black diaspora after that 27 flood.
Right.
And
exactly.
It was, and a lot of, and I only learned about that after, you know, that the tragedy in New Orleans in 2005, that, you know, in some ways it was history repeating itself.
Right.
Not necessarily for the reasons, but, I mean, a storm, but...
houses weren't there.
Yeah, houses weren't there anymore.
You've seen the pictures of like the highest ground for hundreds of miles was the levee of the Mississippi River itself.
Yeah,
because what happened is the levee had broken further up and just flooded, you know, the whole delta, right? You know, and stuff. So the levee itself was the actual high point, and like everybody was just pitched tents and stuff on top of the levee, right? You know, and that's where they're getting the food and the mail and everything else, right? You know.
Mississippi is just in a powerful river because in 93 I was flying to St. Louis and we were flying over the Mississippi, and it was just unbelievable how wide it
was. Right, exactly. And, like, it had breached several places there.
I think even Mark Twain wrote something about, you know, the Mississippi was so wide at some point you couldn't see the other side, you know, from one side of the bank to the other.
Exactly, right, you know. And it's all flat, too. That was the hard part, you know. It's like the, but I wanted that. I wanted that flood in there, you know, and stuff. And that's the one Faulkner used in The Old Man and The Wild Palms, right? You know. But I wanted that flood in there, and I wanted Lindy's flight in there, so I knew it had to be set in like 27 or at some point, you know, right? And like the Coen Brothers was set in some indeterminate time around the cusp of like the start of the Depression, right?
Yeah, certainly you got the feel that it was Depression.
Right,
Depression
exactly,
era.
Right. You know, and of course, the Depression in the South was I mean, how could they tell?
Yes. Said,
right. It's like the old Bill Cosby joke. Our furniture was out on the yard, and my sister had the mumps, and my dad was out of a job and stuff. He said, and then the depression hit.
Right. Yeah.
And like, how can you tell? Right. But it's like, I thought they did an admirable job of transmuting, the Odyssey, right, mm-hmm. and stuff into that time period, right? Like I said, you yep. have to use some of the same things, but like their one-to-one imagery was right on, I thought, mm-hmm. right, and stuff.
Oh yeah. One of the other things, because I kind of, one of the reasons why I went to the panel was obviously I wanted to steal some good questions from Brad, because you always want to steal from the best.
Right.
So,
right.
And I thought about asking you this question. I thought, no, you've probably been asked this 100 times. What would you recommend to new, people that haven't read you before? What would you recommend? Mm-hmm. And Brad, of course, suggested Night of the Cooters.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you agree with that or not, because all your stories are your children, and
right. It's probably right. It's a real accessible story, mm-hmm. Right. You don't have to have any. All the stuff about the War of the Worlds and stuff is in the story, right?
Yeah.
Itself. Everything you need to know about the War of the Worlds is in there, and stuff. Of course, mm-hmm. they always hear it third hand, right? Somebody yeah. comes and tells them about it, and stuff, but. I have a soft spot in my heart for God's Hooks, right? And stuff. But that's a little more distance, right? Because it's said, right in during the Great mm-hmm. Fire of London and plague and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed the short story Mary Margaret Road Grader, because mm-hmm. it as Brad said, not about that story, but it pulled in disparate elements that you wouldn't normally think that went together, because it was kind of it felt like a post-Holocaust story, but it had basically an Indian powwow and
right. It's like I was staying over at a friend's house, and everybody in Austin, when I used to live up around Dallas Fort Worth, I'd go to Austin as often as I could, and everybody was still asleep, and I was sleeping on the couch, and I got up and I put on Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water. And I dropped the stylus on to the opening of Bridge Over Troubled Water, the song,
uh-huh.
right? And the whole story came to me between that then and when I got to the coffee pot to start making the first pot of coffee of the day. The whole thing just came to my head, right? And I sat down and started mm-hmm. writing. And by the time everybody else got up, I'd finished the story already, right? And it was essentially the same story that was published, right? I had to monkey with it a little bit, but it was, you're blessed 3 or 4 times as in your writing career when stories just come to you with no forethought or anything, right?
And then you have to get them out on paper.
Then you have to get them out on paper. That's the only thing. It's like, it's you're not even thinking about a story, with any of those elements or with any of the research you have or anything, and this thing just comes to you, right?
Yeah.
And stuff.
Now, one of the questions about writing, and it's more about probably more about the mechanics, not necessarily where you get your inspiration from, mm-hmm. but and I think for any aspiring writer, is to pick whatever method that's going to be the most productive for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for you, you write a longhand, and then
right.
you put it on, and then you still do a manual typewriter,
yes.
correct?
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. For about the middle 10 years of my career, or the second 10 years of my career, I was still writing on a typewriter. I could still do that, but I hate typing, right?
Yeah.
And once it got to interfering with what I was doing, right, then I quit and went back to longhand, right? Do the first drafts longhand now, right? And stuff. And I always revise on the typewriter while I'm typing it up, right? And stuff. But I'm not doing first drafts on typewriter anymore. But I did at one time, right?
Yeah.
And that's what works for me, right? And I doubt it would work for anybody else, right?
Yeah, I know some people, of course, George R. R. Martin obviously uses a computer.
Right. Right.
And I think the only other person I know that might still use a typewriter, of course, is the infamous Harlan Ellison.
Right. I was astounded to find out that both Don DeLillo and E.L. Doctorow still use typewriters, even though they have computers for their email and for their, you know, research and stuff like that. But they don't type on computers at all.
Well, right? as someone who uses computers all the time, going back to a typewriter just to even play with, the first thing I notice is that return.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
like you're typing along because it wraps on the screen, and then suddenly it's like, you know,
right.
there's this pause, and you got to
right.
start over again.
Right. It's like that's the one thing I miss on computers is there's no return. You know, right? Is there? There's not the noise and stuff either, right? You know, that a typewriter makes, right?
Well, one of the first computers I had you could install these sounds, so it sounded like a typewriter.
Right.
They said like a 1947 under would, you know, chukka chukka chukka.
Chukka, right, exactly, right? You know, and so they don't have those options anymore, I don't think, right? But it's like I miss the return is the main thing because I'm in the actual physical, you know, reaching up and pushing it back, right, you know?
And, of course, there's something to be said about a typewriter, not necessarily the technology itself or the tactile feel, but in that you're not distracted by whatever else is going on your computer. I mean, yeah, you can turn off all the programs, but the temptation is, you know, you got your
right.
instant messaging, your email, stuff like that. And unless you're really disciplined, it's going to be kind of hard to, you know,
right.
turn those off.
As George R.R. Martin said, in something I never thought about because, of course, I don't use a computer, he said, in the past, novels got fat in the middle. In other words, somebody's writing a novel, it gets fat in the middle when they're writing on a typewriter. Because you're writing and you're fudging around with all this stuff and like it's getting, you know, more and more complex and stuff. And so it says then you look down at the pile of paper and notice that it's like this thick. It's like a ream of paper already. You say, I better start wrapping this up. So you start doing this. He says, now, he said, novels written on computers get fat anywhere, and you don't know it. You know what I mean? Unless you're printing out each day's work and stacking it up, right?
Because you don't have a sense of...
But you don't have a sense of how much you've done, right? You know, and stuff, till you print it out and stuff. And he said they can get fat anywhere, right? They get fat in the first chapter. They get fat, you know... 10 pages in and get fat, you know, anywhere, right?
Yeah, because if you're really focused on your work, you can just lose track of time and suddenly realize, wow, look how much work I've done.
Right, exactly. But with a computer word processor, you don't have that unless you're actually printing it out, right? You know, and so, I mean, you can scroll back up through it, but that doesn't tell you anything either, right? You know, except that you've done the work, right? But you don't know how much work it is, right?
The one thing that intrigued me was I knew that, reading and hearing comments from other people that you and George R. Martin were, you know, have been friends for a long time and
right.
he'd corresponded for a while before he actually met in person. But I think what I was intrigued was this Howard and George show. And, I don't know if you did this at Conestoga when you guys were there and I missed it. How did that come about?
It came about I believe it was. Let me see where. I can't remember what convention it was, but we did a Howard George show, and the other one was a Howard Gardner show.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Gardner Dojoie would do a show, and we did one at Baltimore in '83, right? You know, because the ASFA, the artists, you know, were trying to meet next door, and our audience was laughing so much that they couldn't get their business done, so they come over and ask us to move, right? And we had an audience of about 600 people. We said, how many people are over there? And they said, 100 and something. We said, you move, right, you know, because, you know, right, we were, you know, we had 600 people there, right, you know, and stuff like that. But me and Gardner have done the Howard Gardner show several times. Me and George have only done the Howard and George show at least like two or three, right, you know, two or three times in 30 years, something like that, right, you know.
Yeah. I imagine with you and Gardner, because I have seen Gardner talk before, and he told his Army stories.
Right.
So since both of you were in the Army, you probably had some tall tales to swap.
Right. It's like Gardner's safety. Gardner had to write the safety advice column for the 3rd Army, right?
Yes.
And he would have to get all the field reports of things guys had done stupidly, right? You know, stuff like pitching their tents over the exhaust muffler of a tank, right?
Yes.
It was running all night, and, you know, right?
And what I remember about that was it always ended with, if you do this, you will die.
Right, exactly, right. You know, he was in 66, right? He got out of the army in Germany and chose to stay in Germany because he had a real cheap place to work and live, right? You know, and he stayed over there another like almost a year, right? You know, trying to sell stories and stuff. See, he had one of those flukes where this first or second story he ever wrote sold.
Mm-hmm.
So then when he got out of the army, he was like writing stories all the time and nothing sold, right? You know, absolutely nothing sold. It's like same way with me when I used to live around Dallas Fort Worth. And I moved to College Station to live with people for about 6 months, and like absolutely nothing I wrote for those 6 months sold. But when I moved to Austin, like at the end of the 6 months, everything I'd written in College Station sold while I was living in Austin, right?
Well,
you know,
I think you're kind of in good company in that not selling. You sell some stuff, then you're not selling for a while, because I think Connie Willis said at one convention, she had won like the Hugo and Nebula, and then she didn't sell anything for like 3 years after that. You know,
right.
And
it was a long time between her first story and her second one too, if I'm not mistaken. She sold, I believe her first sale was to Galileo or something like that. She hates that story now, right? And then she didn't sell another one for like another 2 or 3 years, right? You know, and stuff like that. And ain't for lack of talent, right? I can tell you that, right? You know, it's something about the market or something,
yeah.
Right? You know,
yeah,
the editors weren't at the right place, right? You know, something like that.
Yeah, it was interesting because you were on a panel yesterday talking about, you know, is hard SF dead, or I forgot what the title of it was. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall. I always think of hard science fiction as being space opera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I know some people say, you know, it's got to have some element of real physics and stuff like that.
Right.
But I always thought of, you know, kind of like there's some space opera set in the future, you know, because like,
right.
You know, E. Doc Smith,
right.
and authors like that. I think the general consensus was you were all lamenting the fact that fantasy was more popular.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, part of that reason was cultural in the dumbing down of America.
Right. The part I lament is that bad fantasy is more popular. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like badly written fantasy is more popular and stuff. Because, like I said, at one time, you know, like all alternate history, all the fantasy stories and novels that were published were good ones, right? You know, and that's why they were memorable and stuff. And then, like after Tolkien, everybody is just, you know, plot coupons, you know, as everybody
yeah.
says, you know, just the quest, and you collect so many things, so the magic sword, the magic cup, whatever, right, you know, and stuff. And it's like, you know, it's like badly written fantasy has taken over, you know, which if it wasn't for badly written fantasy, I'm sure it would be badly written science fiction, right?
That's probably true.
That's right, you know, Sturgeon's Law, right, you know, 90% mm-hmm. of everything is crap, right?
Yeah.
You know,
I got, in high school, a lot of people are reading Lord of the Rings, and I didn't. I was always trying to be different, because I was into the harder SF, mm-hmm. Heinlein, Asimov, Clark, stuff like that. But I had a good friend introduce me to Fritz Leiber and then Roger Zelazny. So mm-hmm. that was my introduction to fantasy. I eventually got around to reading Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still kind of partial to Fawford and the Grey Mousers.
Right, exactly. Right, you know. It's like, you know, maybe I should have brought that up on the Sword and Sorcery mm-hmm. panel this morning. Because, you know, I think that Fawford and the Mouser are waiting for the right movie to come along, you know, the right director and mm-hmm. stuff, and I can't imagine who that would be, right, you know.
I can't either, but I think if they did one, if they just took one short story and they made it into a movie, of course, no one would get it because they'd have to read the rest of the mm-hmm. stories, is Issac of the Jug.
Ilmet and Lankomer?
Well, Issac of the Jug is the one where they, people will have to read that short story.
Right. Remember in Ilmet and Lankomer?
Yes.
Fawford's chained to the bed.
Yes.
Somebody's drunk and they've chained him to the bed. And he was drinking from a jug.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all this talk of religious revival about Issac of the Jug coming
yes.
back. And Fawford, like, breaks the bed up and starts walking down the street, right? You know,
and they had completely
saying, where's my jug? Right? And they think it's Issac of the Jug, right?
Well, you know, they completely shaved him, too, is what I remember.
Right, exactly. Everything, you know, they did everything to you when you're drunk, right? You know, and stuff. It's like, it's amazing. And, like, what Issac had been stretched on a mm-hmm. rack, hadn't he?
Yeah.
So they thought that the remains of the bed were the remains rack. Of the rack, mm-hmm. right, you know, and stuff, right. You know, it's hilarious. I mean, it's like, you know, it's just waiting for the right person to come mm-hmm. along, you know, and adapt that, right, you know,
yeah.
and stuff.
Well, I think it would be good to kind of maybe do a mini-series or animate
right,
or something.
Right, like Adept's Gambit or Scylla's mm-hmm. Daughter would make a, you know, a good, you know, like 90-minute movie, right, you know.
Oh, stuff. Yeah. Well, Howard, I think we're getting close to running out of time here.
Oh, okay.
And because you may have another panel, you may have dinner or something like that. Right. And I certainly don't want to keep it. I have very much enjoyed this conversation. We are probably ought to get back to you. Is there anything that you're working on or anything new that you're getting ready to come out with that you might that the listeners might be interested in? Or
well, the what I'm finishing right now is The Moon World, which is a for lack of a better word, a steampunk novel, right? You know, mm-hmm. it's set in the 1890s about a space race between England and America, right? Because there's been a new, it's complicated, but there's been a new source of propulsion mm-hmm. called slow powder.
Slow powder, okay.
Slow powder, right? You know, and it's caused by the action of tektites on bat guano, right? You know, and there's all these chapters set in the guano states in South America and stuff, right? And Britain and France, because it was originally discovered by French, are trying to corner the slow powder, you know, supply, right? You know, and stuff. And of course, Americans, being what they are, come up with something called artificial slow powder, which is like, you know, they have Edison and people like that mm-hmm. working on it, right, and stuff. That's one of the things when Sterling and Gibson wrote The Difference Engine,
mm-hmm.
I got a copy, and I told them, I said, I can't read this book until after I finish Moon World. Because I know, because the period in which it's set, my people are going to have to go to the same people that your people had to go to, right? Because if you wanted something done, that's who you went to,
right?
Right? You know, and I don't want to see what they did with those people, right? Because I got my own ideas about, you know, the people and stuff. Like,
well,
you know,
that does sound intriguing. I recently read a book called Alchemy of Air by Thomas Hager, which is about the invention of the Haber-Bosch process. Which was the fixing of nitrogen from the air.
Oh, okay. Right.
And I thought of it because in the Hard SF, they brought up that, I cannot remember his name, unfortunately, I will have to put it in the show notes, who was responsible for the Green Revolution, who just passed away.
Oh, Burkhardt?
I think so.
Someone did. Right, yeah.
But I'll put it in the show notes. And they said how he's responsible for feeding all these, you know, billions of people.
Right.
And, of course, without Haber-Bosch, without the fixing of nitrogen, there would be 2 billion less people in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
But he covered a lot of history of the of South America, you know, about the mining of the guano and all the wars that were fought in South America over
right,
it.
Right. Exactly.
So so I'm definitely very intrigued. So I'm looking forward to it.
Right. Right. And then after that I'll finish the search for Tom Perdue for Subterranean, right, which has been owing for years, mm-hmm. right, you know, and like the thing about it is as they've done before, Subterranean's offered to publish a short story collection mm-hmm. in place of it, right? I said, we've already done that, this is the year I finish this, right, you know,
yeah.
and stuff like that. So it'll finally, you know, people have been ordering it for years, right, and I'm sure he's tired of, you know, like either taking the money and hoping that mm-hmm. I'll, you know, finish the book and, you know, he can make print it and send them copies or sending the money back or whatever, right, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're going to finish it. I finally get around to this work. Now, I know that your good friend George R. Martin has been getting a lot of flack from fans over not finishing his mega series and stuff like that.
Right.
Of course, Neil Gaiman put it best by saying, George R. Martin's not your bitch.
Right, exactly. You know, like I said, my story for Warriors was so late that it got in like a week before Gaiman's story,
yeah.
right, you know, and stuff. So, you know, that's really late, right? But like, he's right, you know, right? It's George will finish that when he finishes it.
Yeah.
You know, they'll have to like it, right? You know what
yeah.
I mean, right? You know, if they want to read it, they'll have to wait, right? You know, he never meant to take... I mean, he never meant to start something that was going to take at least 18 years mm-hmm. of his life, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
and stuff, right? You know.
Mm-hmm. And we'll finish on one final question. It has to do with the April Fool's joke that George played on you.
Yes.
And so if you wouldn't mind relating that again.
Well, it's like so many people complain about George taking such a long time to finish it, that he announced on April 1st, right, in Locust, right, that I was going to collaborate with him on the last two books, right, so that they would be done faster and, you know, they would be out there sooner. And then he gave a thing of my career as a sword and sorcery writer, you know, from the early 60s on to the, like, you know, mid 70s and stuff. And people accused him of making all that up, right? And that's the one part of the whole thing that was true, right? You know, it's like I was a sword and sorcery fan back in those days, and I was the art director of a sword and sorcery fanzine, right? You know, for years and stuff. And like, George didn't make any of that up. That part's all true, you know. Everything he said about my credentials is true, right?
You know,
it was just the, you know, the idea, right, was, you know, George wouldn't take me on as a collaborator for a million years, right, although we have written the one story together, right, you know, and stuff. But, it was like, you know, they accused him of making the part about me as, you know, a sword and sorcery writer up, right, and it wasn't. And he didn't make any of that up, right, you know, so...
Well, I think that's going to cover everything. I'm sure we could go on for days and days, but you have the rest of the convention to attend.
Yes.
And I want to thank you for joining me on Escape from Cubicle 17, Howard.
All right. Thanks very much.